Hi, welcome to More Christ. I'm Marcus. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Arthur Vers Lewis. Arthur is Professor of Religious Studies at Michigan State University, and he holds a doctorate from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor in the USA. He's published many books and articles. Among his books are Platonic Mysticism, American Gurus, Magic and Mysticism, An Introduction to Western Esotericism, The New Inquisitions, Heretic Hunting, and the Intellectual Origins of Modern Totalitarianism. And most recently, then, American Gnosis. His family owns a little commercial farm in Michigan. They've done so for generations. And he's also published a book called Island Farm about the family farm and about family farming, I suppose, in the modern era. And Arthur was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to Germany. He's the editor of JSR, the Journal for the Study of Radicalism. He's the founding president of Heros, a nonprofit focused on spirituality and cultural renewal, and some things in line with this channel. And I suppose, first of all, Arthur, can you maybe tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write about the kind of weird and wonderful subjects that you have, more esoteric Christian spiritual living, Jewish Kabbalism, and things like that?
Sure, I'm happy to. When I grew up in a Dutch Calvinist family, and we always had books around, and that was a priority, reading. But I've always been an explorer, and really, most of my work can be understood best, I think, as exploration. So each of these books explores different topics and different themes, and they're all interconnected. So, it's in part bringing readers along on an exploration, but also, it comes from just the love of doing these kinds of things. You feel a calling, you feel a call to do something, and that's the origin really of writing a book. And that's certainly true of all of the books that you mentioned.
That's excellent. Thank you, Arthur. And I suppose something I was interested in was, we were talking about before we started recording about our friend Michael Martin. And I think he's really interested because he's very down to earth. He's got that academic background, but he's also a dynamic farmer and so on. And I think that gives a real root to his writing. And I think the same thing comes across in your work. I wonder how has that kind of down to earth, the nature of farming and things like that, maybe informed your approach to these topics? And has it helped you maybe to avoid a kind of ideism that many academics seem to suffer from? Because, as I say, your work seems to resonate even with broader audiences. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, I think there's a risk of, becoming too abstract and too disconnected from the real world. And when you have to do things like trim trees, which I've just been doing. Fruit trees have to be trimmed, and you have to battle with onslaughts of deer and try and figure out how to protect things from the incredible overpopulation of deer and that kind of thing. It's grounding. It's literally grounding. That's what farming is. And so I think that's a real gift. That's a real blessing that I've had in life, is to be born on a family farm. Now in America, the percentage of family farms, it used to be really high. I mean, it was 70% or something at one time. And now it's, there are statistics saying, it's 1%, or I would doubt it's 1%. Actually, I think that seems doubtful. I think it, really how they calculate it would probably include not necessarily what we would think of as family farms, but still, there's just very, very few. So I've been very fortunate in that regard. And I think that's that, and a connection to the natural world is really vital in the kind of world we find ourselves in today.
That's excellent. And whenever I was reading your work, that came across, and you reference people like Philip Sherrard, who I've been influenced by, and he's got this book about the rape of man and nature and coming to this more constructive relationship with the land, and I'd love to get into some of that with you later. But I suppose first of all, I want to look at some influences. So our friend Michael Martin has referenced you, and he's interviewed you for his podcast and so on. So some of the people in my little corner of the internet may know you through that. But also, I thought quite interesting was John Fravicky has spoke a lot about you and seems to rate your work very highly. And he's quite popular in the little circles that I move in. And I don't know, what's your relationship with him? Do you know him personally, or has he just read your work and been impressed by it? Because he seems to be doing a lot of work on Neoplatonism and things like that and getting people interested in those things again. Do you know him personally, or?
I do know him. I met him virtually, so we've talked. You know, I don't know him. You know, I haven't visited him at his university or anything like that, or vice versa. But we're certainly familiar with each other, and it's nice to hear that he's talking about these kinds of topics. I think, you know, as I outline in the book Platonic Mysticism, there's a whole vast area of the past that has been largely overlooked and has largely disappeared from people's, you know, perception, and it's been replaced by a kind of vague, mushy, sort of globule of what people think of as mysticism, instead of something fairly precise, actually, at one time, you know. So anyway, yeah, I'm familiar with him.
Oh, that's good. And what do you think of how he is looking at those things through the lens, I suppose, of cognitive science? Do you think there's much potential with what he's doing? Maybe how would you evaluate that from your own perspective? Because he's approaching it from this non-theist perspective, but your work seems to strike a very different chord. And I'm personally closer to, from what I can see, to your work than John's, while I can appreciate him. And a lot of my friends are very influenced by him. I wonder, what are some of the distinctives with your book on Neoplatonism and your work more broadly? Or would you care to speak to that?
Well, I think that cognitive science or neuroscience do have things, you know, to show us, because you can look at, you know, different charts or graphs or readouts, and you can see certain things. But the problem, particularly with neuroscience, is that it tends to be brain-centered. It tends to have a whole cluster of assumptions, what we could call preemptive assumptions, maybe, which are materialist, really, and they're brain-centric. So the mind is not the mind is a function. Typically, the assumptions are that the mind is a function of the brain. That's not true, actually, but that's the one of the preemptive assumptions. And so I would say that the mystical tradition, and, you know, the Christian mystical tradition, has things to say about these kinds of things. Of course, you know, I find science and scientific exploration quite interesting. And I think the initiative of, there's a gentleman by the name of Alan Wallace, B. Alan Wallace, and he has a PhD in religious studies, and he's published a bunch of books on topics related to this in relation to Buddhism. And what he's argued for is what he calls contemplative science. And contemplative science integrates these different modes of knowing. The problem comes when a materialist mode of knowing becomes dominant and crowds out the other epistemological ways we have of knowing. And that's very common today. So a contemplative science observatory would be observing consciousness That's something that he's been pushing for. So I think that there are ways to navigate this that are positive, right? But it isn't an automatic that one can easily navigate it. You see what I'm saying? You have to be aware in order to do that. And so those are things that I would say about this kind of general area.
No, that's excellent. Thank you, Arthur. And then I'd love to look at some key influences on your chef then. Are there any figures who come to mind who've been especially important or influential for you in your formation that you'd like to tell us about, whether that be academic, family, friends, or otherwise?
Well, I would say it depends who you're asking for. I mean, it's what you're asking about, because there are so many different people that are influential that, you know, that I don't really know even where to begin. Because if you start with the Christian tradition, there are, of course, figures that are just extraordinary. And, you know, we can talk about those. I would say I've had a lifelong friendship with someone who's a longstanding practitioner. That's been extremely, you know, beneficial. So that's, you know, that's something I can, you know, I could talk about. There are many different approaches. So I guess maybe we should narrow this down a little bit
Let's go with spiritually then. You mentioned figures like Jacob Burma in your works. Maybe we could touch upon someone like that.
Sure. Absolutely. So you know, there's a Christian mystical tradition, a current that goes back to Dionysus the Areopagite. And the treatises that he wrote, like Mystical Theology, which are very clear, not that long, and extremely valuable for the way they allow us to understand what mysticism is in the Christian tradition. And Jacob Burma, I mean, he was prayed. He was a humble man. He was Lutheran, and you know, lived in Germany/Poland. And he was extraordinary at the same time, because he was able to pull together all of these different currents, including alchemy, including mysticism in the tradition of Dionysian mysticism. Eckhart. So Eckhart is part of this current, great Meister Eckhart. All of these different currents he was able to pull together in this synthesis, which retrospectively is called Christian Theosophy. And, you know, I knew that there had to be something like this in the Christian tradition, because, you know, there's Sufism in Islam and so forth. There must have been, right? It must have existed. And so that's why I began to explore these areas. And so Burma is the, around 1600, he inaugurates this current, and he writes these extraordinary books. One of his books, the first one, he showed it to his pastor, and his pastor was horrified and forbid him from writing or publishing. Ultimately, though, fortunately, he did go on to write a great deal more. There are others in this current. There was an English school that developed. Then there were some Americans. But, you know, Burma really is a revelatory figure in a lot of ways, you know, in the Christian tradition. He's not easy. Mostly he's not easy. I won't say he's not easy, because there are some things that are pretty clear, helped along a little bit by some of his ensuing practitioners like William Law. So the William Law translation of some of these works is extremely illuminating and quite accessible, right? So Burma and his school, I found just very fascinating. And so I wrote a trilogy of books, actually, but the primary one is one called Wisdom's Children. And the general one, the one for a general readership, is called Theosophia. And Theosophia I wrote because I didn't see anything like it. And I felt it needed to be out. It needed to come out in the world. And so that's where those books came from. Platonic Mysticism is a much more recent book, but really still in the same current, actually. It's just a different angle. It's a different angle.
Hmm.
So I knew this was out there. Found it, you know. I found it.
That's great. I'm glad you did. Thank you so much, Arthur. And I'd love to delve into some themes from that trilogy that you mentioned. But first of all, I want to kind of clear the ground, because whenever people hear these things, they're going to, or read the title, they're going to unfortunately judge the book by its cover, even though we're told not to do that. And they're going to look at Theosophia and they're going to assume that's Madame Blavatsky and so on. I wonder if you might draw the distinction. What are the key features of this Theosophia going from Dionysius to Burma and those figures, and how does that contrast with that kind of more New Age theosophism of Madame Blavatsky and so on?
Yeah, that's a great proviso to add here, which is, yes, there's a natural confusion. What we're talking about here is Christian mysticism, straight out of the Christian current. In the case of Burma, it is Protestant, but it's not all Protestant. Not everybody is Protestant in this current. Franz von Baader, for example, was Catholic. There's also Orthodox offshoots, you could say, or continuations of this tradition. But it's unambiguously and clearly Christian mysticism. Whereas what happened in the late 19th century is you had Madame Blavatsky and a few other folks create a theosophical society, taking the name and creating a society which is really devoted to a kind of interesting set of hypotheses on things like Atlantis or Lemuria, or these, you know, past histories that they generated and so on, which, however interesting or influential they are, have nothing really to do with the actual tradition of theosophy. So Theosophia, divine wisdom, Theos, Sophia, is the source of that current. And so thank you for remarking on that, because of course people will frequently make that mistake, and the two are quite far apart, actually.
No, that's most clarifying. Thank you, Arthur. And another distinction, which I thought was really important in your book, helped me to see. I was kind of developing these thoughts over a number of years anyway. I was particularly drawn in the past to Eastern Orthodoxy, but then over time, I saw it in some ways as black and white. And there's an organic growth in the church, I think, in the West. And there's certain elements that I can appreciate. So I appreciate the good of Eastern Orthodoxy, but haven't sort of restricted myself to that. And there's a conception now for some people who convert to Orthodoxy, think, well, this is the one true church and everything else is just an aberration from that and so on. But I think as part of that, part of the problem I had was there's this black and white again idea of we are the Orthodox, then there's the Gnostics over here, and Gnosticism completely at odds with Christianity and so on. But yet there is this genuine Christian spiritual gnosis that I think you illuminate in your work and some of these mystics speak to. I wonder if you might tell us a little bit about that distinct nature of spiritual gnosis and maybe how that contrasts with our modern sort of Cartesian modes of knowing and so on.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot there to unpack. And, you know, it's what I would say is, in terms of the Christian tradition, there was among the early church fathers some knowledge of this. And you see it in Clement of Alexandria, for example, where he's writing about false gnosis and true gnosis. And there is within the church itself, and here church broad, speaking really broadly, there is this current that includes gnosis, right? Gnosis is a word for spiritual knowledge. And in the book that I published quite recently, actually about 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, it came out, called American Gnosis, but also in earlier books like Magic and Mysticism, I've discussed this question of what is gnosis. And I think this might be a moment to point out what gnosis is, because people have all kinds of ideas about Gnosticism and are drawing on all kinds of different memes from, you know, different concepts that are reputed to be attributed or attributable to different groups in the early Christian era, this whole congeries of different groups that they call, quote, Gnostic, unquote. And so that's confusing a little bit, because that's a different creature entirely than the question of what is gnosis. And what I do in American Gnosis is I discuss really the mystical tradition, which I also discuss in Platonic mysticism, that when you look at the classical works of mysticism, for example, Dionysius the Areopagite's treatise Mystical Theology, what is the height of that theology? It is transcendence of self and other. It's not this. It's not that. I mean, this is the bulk of the treatise is what it's not. All right. It's not this. It's not that. You think it's this. It's not that either. It's not this. It's not sensory. It is not rational. It's not anti-rational. It's not this. It's not that. It's not conceptual. It's not non-conceptual. So that's a classic statement of what gnosis is, as transcendence. And so gnosis, there are different levels of gnosis. You could argue. So it isn't necessarily only that, but ultimately it is only that. The term is broad enough so you could say there's a kind of political gnosis, political awakening, right? But that's not transcendence. That's a political awakening. So people can use a term in that way. And it's got limited value. It does work. But really, ultimately, it's transcendence. And that would be what Clement of Alexandria would be referring to. That's certainly what somebody like Meister Eckhart is referring to in his many sermons, many enigmatic sermons. Mm-hmm. And that's present in Jakob Boehme. So all of that is what I call gnosis without Gnosticism in the book. On the other hand, you have Gnosticism without gnosis, and there's plenty of that, and we could talk about that. That's a completely different creature, but there's a lot of it, and so those are two different things. Is that helpful?
No, that's most helpful. Thank you, Arthur. And I wonder, would you like to maybe give an example, just while we're on it, of that that latter brand that you're referring to?
You mean Gnosticism without gnosis? Sure.
Yes.
Sure. It's everywhere now if you know how to look. Once your eyes are open to this, you will say, oh, okay, yeah. the simplest way is, and here I'm primarily looking at American, but not only American phenomena. The book, we can easily talk for an hour and not even begin to touch all of the things in the book American Gnosis. So I will keep it very short. If in the book I have a chapter on contemporary film, contemporary films, video, games, and so on, and I go through the ways that what I call neo-Gnosticism appears in contemporary literature, contemporary films. I have a chapter on literature too, a whole series of different figures that I discuss in there, major figures of American literature. All of them have these neo-Gnostic elements. And it's not me saying that. In the literature chapter, I quote other scholars. I mean, I let them make the argument, you know, and he's like half a dozen people saying that Cormac McCarthy is a neo-Gnostic. Well, that makes my case pretty easy, really. So what does that mean? Well, the characteristics of neo-Gnosticism are to regard our society. It's a mode of critique of, ultimately, it's a mode of critique of contemporary society. So it is seeing society as hostile to spiritual growth. It is seeing archons or controlling or would-be controlling figures political or economic positions of power, preventers, creators of artificial realities, artificial worlds like, you know, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, meta. All of this, all of these themes, a demiurge, a false creator, archons, preventers of spiritual knowledge, you know, and so forth, are themes that resonate very deeply with the society we find ourselves in as a way of critiquing it. Mm-hmm. So that's very common in film. You see it in films like The Matrix. You see it in They Live. You see it in so many films. Some films are straight up neo-Gnostic. They're quoting the Gospel of Thomas or something. Others, it's sub rosa, but it's very present in film, and that there's a feedback loop where people use images or concepts from the film in society, like the red pill from The Matrix. Mm-hmm. So you're red pilled, right? What does that mean? It means that you have insight. That's political gnosis. It's understanding that there are archons and there's a demiurge figures like what's his name from Microsoft, you know, Meta, Zuckerberg, Meta, you know, Meta, right? All of this is present in our society. If you could think of a more perverse name than Meta, by the way, I mean, that's so perverse. It's just absolutely perverse when you know what Meta means, mm-hmm. and then you know what they're doing, creating a fake world. Mm-hmm. It's pretty perverse. I mean, you got to admit. So anyway, all of this is to say that our society can be and is understood by a lot of people in neo-Gnostic terms as a form of critique. Mm-hmm. So that's the shortest version I could give to that. There's so much more to say.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Arthur. And then I suppose from your perspective and interrelating it with that spiritual gnosis, what are the virtues and the vices of that neo-Gnosticism? And I suppose it reminds me of a query I've been having recently, because there's this constant hermeneutic of suspicion, so to speak, where figures will want to say, well, it's all really about economics behind it all, or it's all really about their will to power behind it all. And they try to reduce it to these very black and white terms, which maybe the hermeneutic suspicion, I think, in some cases is helpful. But if you override it, I think it's poisonous. And I think it's poisoning a lot of modern storytelling and so on. And every hero has to be torn down and you end up with this transgression for transgression's sake, so to speak. I wonder, is there a parallel with what you're describing? And what are the limitations of that neo-Gnostic approach to critique and so on?
Well, I referred to a theme in the book American Gnosis, which is that you have neo-Gnosticism without gnosis, and you have gnosis without neo-Gnosticism. I think that's pretty accurate, really, as a kind of summary of the findings in the book. So what that means is neo-Gnosticism is really a collection of characteristics that were attributed or could be attributed to Gnosticism in antiquity, but really are found in our society. So it's fundamentally, it's a critique of the society in which we find ourselves. And as such, you know, it's pretty effective as a critique, really, I think. But what is the way, actual way out? When you look at the film, The Matrix, at the end of the film, the character Neo, is the character Neo free? Is he really free? Is he, does he really have gnosis? Is there really gnosis there? I'm not thinking there is, really. There kind of is in a kind of a materialistic way. He sees there's machines, okay, and people are asleep and so on. They're in, you know, and being harvested or whatever. But is there really gnosis in the way we were describing it before? No, there really isn't. So that's really the question is, all right, so you recognize that, quote, meta, let's say, is investing billions of dollars in creating an artificial cosmos for people to languish in. That's a critique of it, you know, that Bill Gates is a kind of, or rather Zuckerberg, Mark Zuckerberg is rather a kind of demiurge figure, who's reportedly said he's modeling himself on God in the Old Testament, you know, and creating worlds and so on. Well, a critique of that from a Gnostic point of view, neo-Gnostic, is pretty effective, actually, really. I mean, he really is. That's pretty demiurge. I mean, that's like pretty hard to say that's not demiurgic, okay? But the question is, what does that do? Like, what does the knowledge do for us, right? In other words, what it does is it tells us that there's something not right here, probably. This doesn't seem right to me. There's some instinctively. But the question is, where does it, you know, where do we go for positive alternatives? Where do we go for a positive path forward? And there you don't get so much of that. It's more a mode of critique. You see what I'm saying?
100%. Now, that's very helpful, Arthur. Thank you so much for that. And I think that will resonate with a lot of people on my channel and some of the questions that we've been wrestling with. And it's constantly, we have a little group that meets up and there's just constant wrestling with modern technology and so on. And it aligns very much with your thesis, the way these conversations play out. But and we're seeking to go beyond that from a distinctly Christian perspective. And I think it ties in nicely with the next question I had in mind. So one of the things, again, that is told in a very simplistic manner is that, well, Christianity is all about kind of agapeic love and so on. And in some ways, there actually has been, as Nietzsche has talked about, this poison of eros. But again, I don't think that is intrinsic to the Christian faith itself. I think that's actually a perversion, and that there is this healthy religious eros. And you point to that in your book, and you highlight some of these figures like Dionysius who write and involve us in this eros. Would you like to speak to that religious eros and how that plays its role in this kind of hidden Christian community across the ages, from Dionysius and those others in the East to Burma and figures in the West?
Well, I think one of the most fruitful areas to look at there is not one that I'm familiar with it, of course, but I'm, you know, because I'm talking about it, but I'm not really, I haven't really specialized in it. And I'm referring here to the Russian, what's called the Russian Sophianic tradition. Because there are these Russian authors that have written about the importance of spiritual eros and spiritual transformation and the spiritual significance of Sophia in in relation to nature and in relation to human life, that set of themes is found in figures like Bulgakov, figures who wrote around before the communist takeover in Russia. There was what's called the Russian Silver Age. And that was this kind of efflorescence of people who were writing and working with these kinds of themes in the Orthodox tradition. And I didn't really refer, I referred to it, but I don't really expand it. I'm not fluent in Russian. That's not really my area, but that's where one area that I would point people to. The other is the alchemical tradition, because there is an alchemical aspect of Burma. Burma speaks very clearly in alchemical terms. What is alchemy? Alchemy is a transformative path understood in this context. Now, of course, there are people working in laboratories and people working with plants and minerals and so on. There is that dimension of alchemy, but there's also a contemplative dimension of transformation. And you see that in classical alchemical works, like, for example, the Rosarium Philosophia, which is a series of images, alchemical images, that show a male and female figure, a king and queen. And the king and queen join together and they become an androgyne figure, a male-female figure. And the final in the sequence is the risen Christ. So it's very clear that there's this transformative path. I mean, you see it visually in the images, and it's a path of male-female union, but it's also a path of ultimately there's a spiritual son. So the second, you know, an image later in the sequence is a spiritual son illuminating earth. And then the final image is the risen Christ. So there is this tradition in alchemy of the transformative and healing power of Eros in a spiritual context. That does exist, actually. So, you know, those are the two things I would say about that.
No, that's excellent. Thank you, Arthur. And you've also written a book, which I've got on my to-read list, about a spiritual marriage. Does that tie in with what you're describing? And I know from my conversations with Michael Martin, we were both keen to emphasize how we might know God and the transcendent through things like marriage and sexuality. And I wonder, is that something that runs alongside with what you describe in your work? So you describe this kind of super sensual element to theosophy and so on, but you also have this place for the liturgy, and you hold the Eastern Orthodox Divine Liturgy and the Latin Mass and so on in high esteem, and they are, God is speaking to us through the senses in those instances. Is it a matter of both and, so to speak?
Yes, I think there are different ways you can approach the same subject. So there are different, you could say, different angles. And so different books that I've written approach these different subjects from different angles. So if you're focusing on the Platonic tradition, then it's still pretty much the Christian mystical tradition, but you're looking at the Platonic aspects of it, right? Mm-hmm. Then if you look at it from another angle, then you get, you know, a book like Theosophia, which includes these elements like that you're referring to, you know, liturgical elements, the power of liturgy in the Orthodox tradition. That isn't so present in a book like Platonic mysticism. I did do a book, wrote a book some years ago about the tradition of mysticism, sexual mysticism, that current and different aspects of it historically. up into the, you know, not quite the present, but relatively recent past, one figure that I discuss in there, and he's now very little known. I would say it's a certainty that I've read more of his work than anyone alive. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure of that. And that's an American by the name of Thomas. He was actually Scottish, but an American by the name of Thomas Lake Harris, who created these Christian utopian communities that flourished, really. One was in New York State and one was in California. And spiritual marriage was an important part of his work, his life work, and what. And so I discuss him a bit in that book. He comes to mind now because I was asked to do an article on his work in relation to 19th century American, what they call this group called scriptural production. And I thought, well, I can do that. So I wrote about his work. Harris is a classic example of what we're talking about in a lot of ways. He was accused of all kinds of scandal. And yet when you become really familiar with his work, you realize that he was quite abstemious, and he encouraged celibacy. And the spiritual marriage he was talking about was spiritual. I mean, it was spiritual. And so, meaning not physical, as in asceticism, very ascetic. So it's an interesting area to look at, and there's a lot of different aspects to it. But I mention Harris because he's just wild. He's a wild figure. And now almost completely forgotten.
That's really interesting, Arthur. And another important point that came across when I was reading your work was you mentioned historically how things developed, that theosophy became very individual in part, or it was pertaining to small communities in part because the church became so corrupt, unfortunately, whereas Dionysius and figures like that are in the earlier days, you might have had a greater communal element. I think that's particularly interesting now from an Irish perspective, say, where you give hope to people, I think, that God can still be operative in their lives, even when the church has been corrupted, as say in Ireland, there was the awful case of abuse and all that kind of stuff. I wonder if you might speak to that and lessons from the theosophers across the ages in reading God's work in their lives, again, I suppose, esoterically, and not that you're throwing out the exoteric, so to speak, but the importance of that emphasis and maybe how. Maybe a warning for people in Ireland, for example, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Does that make sense?
Well, you know, I think one of the things to bear in mind is, you know, of course, the path of spiritual work ultimately is one's own. In other words, you know, we're called to we have our own calling, as it were, individually. And so you can't throw out completely the idea of individual, the individual path, because that's in the very nature of things, of who we are as human beings. At the same time, when you look at the history of Christian theosophy, it definitely includes communities. And what's called English theosophy, they were a community. Now, some of them, the group largely under a man named John Portage, which included people like Thomas Bromley and a handful of others, they were a community devoted to essentially what we would today we'd call contemplate. They wouldn't use the word, probably these words, but contemplation, meditation, spiritual practice. That was their primary. And there's a beautiful, there's an amazing work by Thomas Bromley called The Way to the Sabbath of Rest. And in it, he talks about what it's like to be in this community of shared transformation. And it's a remarkable story that he tells. It's remarkable, the experiences that he relays. At the same time, that group then was taken over later by Jane Lead, or Led. And she was much more apocalyptic, much more, you know, end of the world is coming, kind of, that was her inclination. And it was just suddenly a very different group, right? It was not really, it was a continuation, of course, of the earlier group, but it also, you know, took on her particular, what's the term? You know, her particular kind of proclivities, which changed it. And, you know, ultimately it disappeared. And I think these groups appear and then they have their life and then they disappear. And that was true of the, you know, Wissahickon community in Pennsylvania, the with Kelpius, who was a theosopher kind of continuing this tradition. They last for a while. And then they kind of disappear. And there are reasons, I'm sure, for them disappearing. So I think a balance of the individual and community is probably what you're referring to in your question, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Yes, it sort of ties in with what I described about the liturgy and things like that, too, that we can experience God through these different elements. I think that's important and very helpful. And another thing I think I appreciate about your work, as you've hinted at earlier, it's ecumenical in a way that's quite profound. I think that you choose these figures from Eastern Orthodoxy, Catholicism, Protestantism, and show how in some ways, even if the external rituals are different, there's this consistency and continuity across the universal church. So I think that's all very helpful and encouraging to me. It's, as the heart of my channel is more Christ, it's going beyond those, not that you abolish distinctives or anything like that, but you do find these brothers and sisters of the soul across at different times, across the world and so on. I think that's all good. And another element actually that I wanted to ask you about that you illuminate in your work, in the latter part of your book on Theosophia, is this element of pilgrimage, Arthur. And I wonder if we might draw a contrast between that and our kind of, again, our modern notion of tourism, which is, I think, a lot more of a shallow concept. And then maybe whether you want to include this question, or we could go on to it afterwards, if you might refer to this notion of the apocalypse of the heart and why it's significant then.
Well, they're different, you know, different questions there, really.
Yeah.
And one of them has to do with a difference between tourism and pilgrimage, and that's true. Also, actually, that distinction is true in terms of reading, because there's kind of tourist reading, right? Where we can go back and look at something, but it really doesn't reach us, right? And the academic world actually enforces that to a considerable extent nowadays, even regarding it as sinful. From an academic point of view, sinful. The great sin is the great sin is what's called, in some scholars' point of view, is what's called religionism. Because if you're coming from a materialist and trying to enforce a materialist worldview in the humanities, then those who are coming from a point of view that accepts, recognizes the religious dimensions of religion, those are what are people paradoxically, like me, called religionists. And that's a pejorative. That's bad, right?
Yeah.
Well, what is that kind of language doing? Now, of course, it's absurd. It's completely absurd because, I mean, if someone who studies physics, a physicist, is that bad? Is like physicist a term of like abuse that you hurl at people? We're physicists studying physics. I mean, so a religionist is a term of abuse that we're going to hurl at people who are studying religion as if it were true, right? I mean, it's comical. It's completely comical when you think about it. But that's the world we're living in. What I'm saying is that the academic worldview today tends to lean toward a materialist, enforcing a materialist worldview. And that then turn enforces a kind of tourist mentality where you can look, but you're not going to understand and you're not going to touch. You're not going to engage. You're not going to be transformed because you can't. Why? Because you're a tourist. And it's enforcing tourism in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is pilgrimage? Pilgrimage, you're actually affected. You're affected by where you go. Now, where you go is not necessarily only physical, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily you can go to read Meister Eckhart and try to understand Meister Eckhart from Meister Eckhart's own point of view, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not be, you know, declaiming how he is X or Y bad thing because of your contemporary political or other, you know, preconceptions, but rather, what is he actually saying? And that's the difference between pilgrimage, where you're being affected by an understanding and really working with at a deep level where you are, and tourism. So I think those are two different things. And I think that's a important distinction actually to make.
That's really helpful. Thank you, Arthur. And I wonder if you might speak to this apocalypse of the heart. This is something, even the etymology of apocalypse, I thought was quite helpful. And my friend Paul Kingsnorth, he used that word a lot whenever COVID happened, and I think shone a lot of light for people. Would you speak to that idea and how it's significant?
Well, what I would say is in the theosophical tradition of Burma, there's an image. And the image that comes to mind, and the image is an eye in the heart. It's actually in the, it's a, once you see it, you'll say, ah, yes. And it exists in a Protestant context. It exists in a Catholic context. And it's an esoteric image. It's the eye of the heart. And that's a different, what that's saying is that there's a different way of knowing. There's a different way of seeing. So you have the eyes, you know, with which we see, but the eye of the heart is a different kind of knowledge. It's a different kind of knowing. And so there's a distinction between those two. And that's why the theosophers, you know, included this image. And you see it in, it's actually in the frontispiece to Way to Sabbath of Rest by Bromley. So the apocalypse of the heart, what does the word apocalypse mean? Apocalypse really means revelation. It means unveiling. It means the unveiling of what's really there, what's really true. So there are different ways to understand that, but one is, you know, yes, we're in a time that's really challenging in a lot of ways, and in many ways, I think Western civilization and the world is being deconstructed. Ways of understanding in the past are falling apart or being destroyed, and in that context, an image like eye of the heart, it's really very different way of understanding things. It's a, it represents a different epistemology, a different mode of knowing. And so ideas and terms and images like this, they're on the one hand, things look dire, and yet on the other hand, there are all kinds of extraordinary things that are now coming out or being revealed. And that's an apocalypse of the heart of a very different kind. What I'm saying is it's not necessarily a negative, right? Mm-hmm. It's also a positive. We have this kind of dual reality we're living in. Mm-hmm. Many positive things that are unprecedented, yet simultaneously many things that are also unprecedented, but not so good.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Arthur. And another question I wanted to ask you was about, so in Theosophia, for example, it becomes clear that this is a kind of hidden tradition in some ways. It's about initiation and so on. There were a lot of these smaller communities. So someone listening to our conversation might be interested. And what if they're interested in more than just reading about it? What if they're interested in engaging in certain practices and so on? What advice would you have for those, and how pertaining to how we might retrieve this gnosis for the present age, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a great question, you know, because that's something that I've reflected on for some time. And so I've worked with a friend who's, by training, he's a clinical psychologist, and we've worked together for many years. He has worked within the Theosophic tradition for almost his entire life. And so we put together a book of our conversations several years ago called Conversations in Apocalyptic Times. And that book was a kind of really a collection of advice for people who see that something's awry, and they want to begin to explore things in a deeper way. So that was just our initial set of conversations. And then since then, we've been working together for now about 3 years to put together, you know, a synthesis of the Theosophic alchemical tradition in a way that is understandable, that is not in arcane, you know, 17th century language that is almost inscrutable and full of references that are completely inscrutable, and but in modern, very contemporary language. So that's actually something that we're working on right now. I'm working on it with him. Also, on Hieros Institute, which is, or Hieros, depending on whether you want to go with Anglo or American side of the pronunciation. At Hieros Institute, we put together a course, which is an initial course, a kind of foundational course, and we're going to do a second one as well. And the second one is drawing on these conversations that we've recorded, and then drawing on imagery that supplements it, and that we discuss and so on. So we're working on it. That is the short answer. And the place that we're working on it with co-explorers is Hieros Institute, which is, the URL is actually those two words with a dot in the middle, which nowadays you can do. It doesn't have any .coms or anything in there. It's just those two words with a period, which is great. I mean, so, you know, anyway, that's something that we're working on. And, you know, I think it's what I was referring to. After we finished the final conversation in the series, there are 12 of them, we paused, we stopped recording, And I said to Bob, this has never been done before, has it? Anywhere, ever. And he said, no, no, this is new.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so before I became a believing Christian, actually, Arthur, and it happened in a really strange way, I was reading about Islamic mysticism and about Henri Corbin, and was really interested in Sufism and Sufi practices for a number of years. But then whilst reading about that, I saw a footnote about Orthodox iconography and so on, about how you could know God through the creation, and there was this value to the created world, and just clicked in my mind and heart and everything simultaneously. And I've thank God I've been exploring some of these issues from a distinctly Christian perspective since. But one thing that you brought up in your book that I'm interested in asking about is how we might appreciate the good of imagination and the imaginal world and so on that you describe, in a way comparable to what Henri Corbin is doing for Islam and for Sufism, things like that. And I suppose how it might supplement some other forms of mysticism, and the dark night of the kind of Western Catholic tradition and so on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And there are different ways that, you know, we could talk about that, because of course, you know, Corbin and his particular language for talking about this is so wonderful, right? He gives these terms and explains them in ways that we can draw from them, and we understand what he's saying in a new way, right? Our understanding is changed by what he provides us. And I think that was a real contribution that he made, a collection of contributions, really. What he's writing about in Sufism, or allied, you know, Islamic mystical traditions, currents, does that exist in the same way in the Christian world? Not exactly the same, I don't think. It's not identical. But there are some things that are related to it that are really helpful. One thing that I will mention, and I will point people towards, is the work of a writer, Scottish writer by the name of R.J. Stewart. R.J. Stewart writes about vision and visionary experience and its importance in terms of understanding the deep dimensions of nature. And he's coming from a very particular current, very particular perspective, and it's very different in some ways outwardly from Corbin, whom I think he never mentions, but he, and I don't think he's particularly interested. He doesn't need that, because he's coming from his own current, has his own things to say. And, you know, I think there are authors, there are people who represent, you could say a Western European or Christian currents that are not so necessarily so well known, mm-hmm. but really provide insights and are not, even though they're not well known, working with them, at least in my case, has been really helpful. So I think there are other things I could say. You know, we could refer to Kathleen Raine and Philip Sherrard and, you know, all of the folks who did Yeoman's work. You know, Michael Martin has done some, has written on, you know, themes of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of these are important, I think.
No, that's brilliant. And I wonder if you might speak to that, I suppose, maybe tying it in with an interest in Sherrard. I think I do really like Sherrard, but I think he's too anti-Western, and I disagree with that part of his work. I like Metropolitan Callisto Swire said the same thing. He was a good friend with Philip, but it's like this black and white view that the West is bad and the East is good, I think is nonsense now that I the more I've read over the years and so on. But I think he's really good, and I think Sherrard, someone like that, is really good. Like what I was referring to earlier, I think unfortunately Christianity, not intrinsically, I think there is a side that's more affirming of sexuality and so on, and I think that's a concern that Michael and I share, and how we can experience God through our marriages and sexual relationships and so on, I think is important. And I think that's something that Sherrard actually brings out in his work. He critiques actually both the Orthodox and the Western Christians for that, which has been really helpful to me. But another area of his work that maybe we could tie in here is this rape of man and nature, and how modern science is so desecrating. And that seems to be something at the heart of your work, that how we might come to appreciate the creation more constructively, and what are some practices that we might develop to treat it more reverentially, in contrast to this kind of apocalyptic in the bad sense of the world is going to end in 12 years if you don't give us this, you don't give the government your complete support for their initiatives and global warming and so on. Would you like to speak to that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you something that happened here in Michigan in the last couple of weeks. And that is, we have a complete hegemony of one political party in the state. They control every political office, major state office. They control both houses of legislature. They control the Supreme Court. So they control everything. And what did they do? Well, the people in the township next to where I live were fighting to prevent this giant solar array being put in the middle of their township. They didn't want it there. And there were signs everywhere. People put up signs. They fought long and hard to defeat a proposal to put it in there. 2 days after they defeated the proposal, the legislature passed and the governor signed an override. And the override is, their hypothesis is that they will put 200,000, more than 200,000 acres of land into these solar and wind arrays. That's going to be largely agricultural land. Now, I want to think about this for a moment here, because this is all ecological, mind you. So what is ecological here? Well, 200,000 acres that are going to be flattened. They made it so that you can put a gravel mine in all over the place because you can't stop it. You can't stop the new ecological giant 1,000-acre solar arrays because they're going to be approved in Lansing, in the capital, not at a local level. Well, why am I mentioning this? Because here is what is being presented as ecological. Bulldozing an entire biological area, okay? Putting in a strip mine to dig up gravel to cover the ground that is now flattened and remove all of the foliage, right? All of the flora and fauna are removed. And you put in a plastic and glass solar array. Now, that is now coming to 200 and some thousand, by their estimate, 200,000 some thousand acres of productive land or wild land. Now, that is a mentality that produces an ecological solution that is profoundly non-ecological.
Mm-hmm.
That is a materialistic, dualistic, exploitive solution, which is generated by these corporations that pay people off in order to get the legislation in order. I mean, I know the story, right? Mm-hmm. So I know the background, how that all works. But the reason I mention it is that there's a completely different way of understanding the natural world. Completely different. Okay, what I just told you is profoundly unecological. It is anti-environment. It's anti-biology. It's anti-human in the guise of being ecological. What would be ecological? They could have done the same thing in a very different way. They could have encouraged people to each have their own solar array. So everybody has solar arrays outside their houses. You don't need to bulldoze 200,000 acres of farmland and woods, right? You don't have to. You could. And so a completely different worldview needs to be developed in order to preserve the natural world, because it needs to be conserved, right? It needs to, we are called to that. And so I think that is not answering the call. So yes, there are ways of understanding the natural world that are fundamentally different. And I think we really are in circumstances that call for those ways to become more widely understood. And how we get from here to there, that's a good question, right? Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I'm not sure. I really am not sure. But I think Christianity actually has much to say in its history. And many authors have spoken to the kind of human nature, spiritual balance that you see in some experimental efforts as well over time. Things like the distributist community, mm-hmm. you know, communities and so on. There are many, I think, positive examples of more balanced ways of being. And I think it's crucial that we begin to develop those now. That's why my current thought is actually around questions of community and transformative community, because I think now it's critical. It's really critical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my response.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much, Arthur. And I think it's a testament to the likes of yourself and Dr. Michael Martin that you are doing this work in farming, and you're reminding us at different levels in terms of how you're modeling the behavior and about some of the things you're illuminating with your written work. And I'm very grateful for that. And I suppose that part of the challenge will be vis-a-vis this new totalitarianism that you talk about. Actually, the last book I wanted to get into with you today, if we have time, is that the new inquisitions and this heretic hunting and the origins of modern totalitarianism. And a lot of this seems to be well-intentioned, and to your point, it manipulates the positive language. And Ivan Illich talks about this, the corruption of the best becoming the worst, and these things are seen as caring and all, but they're just so destructive. And I think listening to some interviews of you, you seem to have, you've called out different forms of totalitarianism, say the far right, things like that. But you seem to, like Dr. Michael Martin in some ways, being surprised by the new left and so on, who I think are guilty of this perversion of language, and the fruits of some of the things that are doing are quite rotten. I wonder if you might speak to that and how that ties in with your book, The New Inquisitions, then.
Sure. That book was really looking at a current that exists in the Christian tradition, which goes back to the early church fathers. Some of them, not all of them, some of them were virulently opposed to all kinds of things. And that includes things that were actually positive, you know. So you want to talk about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. People like Tertullian, we're pretty good at that. And so you have a history of that. And I go over that in the book, in the Christian tradition. Then you have the inquisitional history itself, which I discuss. And you know, there were extraordinary people who were burned to death. I think here of Margarita Porete. She wrote this book of mysticism, beautiful little book of mysticism. It's a lovely little book called Mirror of Simple Souls. I mean, Simple Souls, Mirror of Simple Souls, okay? She was burned to death for that book. Now, you look at that and you just, you can't believe it, really. That's just one example, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's fast forward to today. Now, you're absolutely right that what we see on the left in contemporary American society is a kind of quasi-religion. It's a quasi-religious faith, pseudo-religious. The word really is pseudo. It's a pseudo-religious faith. And if you dissent from that faith, what happens? Well, they talk about it as cancel, right? As canceling. But actually, the word cancel is a little anodyne, because what's happening, and it's happening in Britain as well, is people, the effort is made by acolytes of the faith to remove financial sources, to bankrupt people, to, so all sorts of means are used under the so-called canceling. That's a form of soft totalitarianism. It's enforcing ideology through soft totalitarian means. I discuss that in the book. Mm-hmm. There's something else I also should mention as a contemporary phenomenon. So the left in its ideological hegemony, I mean, it's pretty hard to argue that that's not soft totalitarianism, as I discuss it in the book. However, some of the reaction to that has taken the form of Christian nationalism. And if you read The Case for Christian Nationalism by a very smart author by the name of Stephen Wolfe, he wrote that book. If you read through the book, he's very intelligent. You get about 3/4 of the way through the book, and here's my point. He's making an argument that you need a Christian nation. All right. It's The Case for Christian Nationalism, the title of the book. Now, what happens if you have heretics? He then asks. Mm-hmm. And his answer is, well, if you go back in Reformed theology, so you go back in Calvinist theology, you get people like Servetus, whom Calvin's folks had killed as a heretic, right? And, you know, Reformed theologians, and he lists them, these theologians concur that sometimes you have to have the death penalty for heresy. So this is a very recent book. That is, now, is heretic hunting on the right the solution to heretic hunting on the left? I'm thinking no. Absolutely. I'm thinking no. I'm thinking that is not a good solution. There are podcasters out there. There's one character who goes around, you know, and he has determined in his infinite wisdom that everybody who is bad should be called a Gnostic without any clear knowledge of what Gnostic even means. He doesn't know what Gnostic means. He hasn't any idea, really, but it's a way of hunting heretics, right? Heretic hunting, okay, we have to understand that these tendencies are embedded. They are like, heretic hunting is an embedded pattern in Christian tradition, and then it gets crossed over into secularity. It goes into the secular world, and then it gets applied against Christians who become the heretics from the secular faith, right? And then you have the reaction of the Christian nationalists or whomever, who then see the other as the heretics, right? Who are the heretics? Well, it's the people who believe in the pseudo religion. So we got to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And neither of these, none of these are healthy. These are not healthy. None of it is healthy,
mm-hmm.
right? In my opinion. Because what you're seeing, instead of movement towards spiritual life, toward grace, toward spiritual awakening, is hunting for the bad other.
Mm-hmm.
That is inherently dualistic. That is dualism refined, right? It is the other is the bad. Me, I'm great. I'm great. And it is you over here. You're the heretic, right?
Mm-hmm.
That thinking is very, very sick. And so that's what you have, right? And that dynamic is kind of, so we have to guard against it. We have to be aware of it and recognize it, you know? And people don't like to hear this. They hate this. They hate this. Because if you start talking about inquisitional thinking, they're all going to hate it, okay? Nobody is going to, who's going to like it? Are the people on the left going to like it? No. Because what are they doing? They're heretic hunting right and left, right? And I'm a heretic now. Here I'm a heretic. Then who's on the right? Are they going to like talking? No, this isn't good. So who's going to like it? I have no idea. I'm not speaking to any good audience here, I guess. But there must be somebody, right?
Yeah, that's great. That's most important, Arthur, and I appreciate that. And I should say that I would not identify with the right by any means, to be honest. So I critique the left, the new left, particularly a lot on my channel. I think because in Ireland they have such a strong hegemony, and it's more obvious. We don't really have a far right or anything, even though it is a bit of a bugaboo that the media throws out as if anyone with any criticism is far right and therefore evil. To your point, there's just dualistic system. But I, to your point, I would hope to transcend that. And I think this emphasis on spiritual gnosis does transcend that and avoids that. I suppose it's in some ways, to think of René Girard, it seems to be this mimetic contagion, what you describe, they're copying one another. And there's that problem of identitarian politics that now that there's a lot of talk about your blackness and so on. So now the white identitarians are coming back, and it's pretty disgusting, really. So I reaffirm what you say. And even though there might be few of us, we have to speak the truth in love. And I think I welcome that from you, and I welcome that from Dr. Michael Martin, who's had his own struggles. He has battles with some more fundamentalist types online who he says probably would burn him at the stake if they got the chance.
Well, that's the thing. It happened. It has happened historically. You know, it's mind-boggling for us to, you know, think about it in the contemporary era, but, you know, it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the phenomena we're talking about is a variant of it. It's a variant. It's a secular variant of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there's much more to say about all this, but, you know, I think those are enough remarks for now.
No, that's wonderful. Yep. And thank you so much for your time today, Arthur. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. And I encourage folks to read your books and get involved with the websites that you mentioned and so on. I suppose just to that end, is there anywhere you want to recommend that they go, maybe your listeners go, to learn more about you and your work?
Well, I have the website, arthurversluis.com, which is just overview. It includes a few, you know, a few references and so on, but hyros.institute is a place that includes conversations with some different folks, and also some other resources. So that's a place to keep an eye on, because there's more things to come, and there's a kind of related interconnected aspect to all of it. So I really appreciate the chance to talk with you and, you know, talk about these different things. You know, it's a great pleasure, and I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Arthur, and God bless you.
And you too.
Nobody can stop me. Ooh, I'm going there. Don't you wanna go too? I'm going there. Nobody can stop me. I'm on my way. I'm going there.
I'm going there.
Nobody can stop me. Ooh, I'm going there.